The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a story from the ancient world that reminds us that politics has always been a winner-take-all game, whether it's from the ancient world or from the criminal underworld or today's politics. James Rahm is a professor of classics at Bard College, the author of three books on the ancient Greek world, The Edges of the Earth in Ancient Thought, and Herodotus. His latest book details the politics and conflicts surrounding the succession to inherit the empire created by Alexander the Great following his death. We know the story of Alexander's conquest from Macedonia and the Balkans through Central Asia as far as India and through North Africa. But Professor Rahm says the breakup of the Macedonian Empire was sealed within 7 years of his death in 323 BC, a result of a half dozen confidants of the king, all fighting for power. His book, Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire, is published by Knopf. He joins us today to tell us a little bit about the history of the ancient world. James Rahm, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Your book, Ghost on the Throne, begins really with the last days of Alexander the Great, and then how basically this empire that he had managed to build in the course of one life literally collapsed on itself. It has the making of an HBO miniseries because the intrigues are worthy of any mobster series or you know, war series. We have such a fascination with the Roman Empire. I don't think the Macedonians have anything on the Romans here.
No, you're right. And the comparison with a mafia series like the Godfather films is very apt because in both situations you have a cadre of men who are completely ruthless, willing to do anything to gain power, and where there are really no rules. There are no laws binding what people can do to each other. So that's the situation that I tried to capture in the book, the first 7 years after Alexander's death and all of the skullduggery and mayhem that happened in those years.
You know, I've always found it interesting how a little place like Macedonia could conquer half or most of the known world at that particular point. And I guess it began with Alexander's father, Philip, who was assassinated. How was Macedonia able to do this?
That's mainly a military story. The development of Philip's army, which quickly became the most powerful fighting force that the ancient world had ever seen. Philip made certain innovations in land warfare, principally the introduction of a spear called the sarissa that doubled the length of the infantry spears in use in that day, and a set of tactics that enabled his phalanx to use that weapon. And it quickly became clear that the Macedonian phalanx could defeat the Greeks, who up until that time had been the land superpower, the predominant force in land warfare. And they were more than a match for the Persians because they defeated Persian armies many times their size.
Mm-hmm.
So the development of a new army with new weapons and tactics and the constant drill that Philip used to bring them into tip-top fighting shape.
Now, was Macedonia different than the sort of the area we expect of as modern-day Macedonia, you know, that area between the former Yugoslav Republic and northern Greece? Was it a different area? Was it more people at that particular time?
Well, the problem with the term Macedonia today is that it's contested by two different nations.
Maybe three if you include Bulgaria.
Well, yes. So if you're speaking of the Greek province of Macedonia in northern Greece, that is approximately the southern portion of ancient Macedonia. But there's also the modern former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which mm-hmm. is a Slavic nation with the capital of Skopje. And that's well inland from the region that used to be called Macedonia in ancient times. So it's a confusing situation with the nomenclature. But if you think of modern Greece, the northern part of modern Greece around Thessaloniki, that's approximately the center of ancient Macedonia.
Mm-hmm. Was it a very populous area? Because this is the thing that's interesting to me is that, you know, they were able to hold it together. You know, they're going as far as India, Afghanistan, what we would call now the Central Asian republics. You know, the stands. They were going as far west as Morocco. How could a little country, even if they did have superior weaponry and techniques, how were they able to conquer that far with just such a small population base? Or was it a larger population base at that point?
It was a fairly large population for its time in that it was a large region geographically. Mm. Macedonia in some ways was the only nation in the modern sense in the Balkan Peninsula. The Greeks had their city-states, but they were very small in terms of acreage and could only support small populations. Macedonia was a much larger area, and then under Philip, it expanded hugely by conquering much of the Balkans. So if you put all that land together, you had a number of different populations and a fairly large base on which to draw. But even so, Alexander's army was at most 50 or 60,000, and as I say, was fighting against forces many times its own size. So population only tells part of the story.
What was at the root of their desire to conquer the world? Was it a need for spices? Was it a need for riches? What exactly?
Well, they didn't share a desire to conquer the world. The desire was largely Alexander's and perhaps his echelon of loyalists, his senior officers. The rank and file don't seem to have wanted to go nearly as far as Alexander did, and in fact they mutinied on the banks of a river that is today part of the Indus River Valley and forced him to turn around when he really wanted to go further. He probably would have kept going until he reached the Pacific if his troops hadn't stopped him. But the story of what motivated his conquest is very hard to unravel. It's really a psychological story, and we don't have good access to Alexander's psychology. The Greeks attributed to him something they called pathos, which means roughly a yearning, that he was constantly seeking to go further, do more, to rival the gods with his achievements, kind of restless ambition that could never be quenched. You think of a modern-day financier who has earned mega millions in the financial markets but continues to place huge bets and look for ever bigger deals. It was that kind of drive, I suppose you could say.
And at the time of his death, as you mentioned, the military had mutinied at one point and basically forced him to head back west instead of going east. He really didn't have a clear line of succession. He had a small group of they were bodyguards, but they were sort of like this circle of seven, if you will. Can you explain that? Yeah.
The office of king in the Macedonian nation was all-powerful and central to the society, especially the military. He was commander-in-chief and top general and top warrior of the army, in addition to being king of the nation. And to protect him in battle and out of battle, he had a team of seven high officers whom he called bodyguards. They were not just a security force, but also his cabinet, his inner circle, to whom he entrusted his counsels and his top commands. And these were mostly men that he had grown up with, who were about his age, and who were his most trusted friends. And they're the main characters in my story because they're the ones who had to make the decisions about the future of the empire after his death.
Of course, Alexander had one child, who had become Philip III, and he was...
Well, the child actually was Alexander IV.
Oh.
His brother, his half-brother, became Philip III. Yes, and those two together were the joint successors to his throne.
And Philip III, a half-brother who was, we believe he was mentally disabled in some way, right?
That's right.
And Alexander IV was not yet born. He was, his wife was pregnant with him.
At the time of Alexander's death, that's right. His wife Roxanne was about 6 months pregnant, and his officers decided to wait and see if the child was a boy, and then select the next king. Presumably, they would have selected the son. But his rank-and-file soldiers rebelled against that decision and chose instead to put Philip III on the throne, even though he was incapable of rule. He was mentally disabled, as you say, because they couldn't tolerate the idea of the son of an Asian woman becoming their next king. Mm. Roxanne was a Bactrian from what is now Afghanistan and was part of Alexander's plan to create a hybrid ruling class that would fuse Asian and European bloodlines.
And this is one of the interesting storylines, again, getting back to this mafia sort of connection. You know, you have all these cabals going on, and you have the rank-and-file soldiers who have seen what was once a Macedonian Greek army become really an Asiatic army with a few Macedonians.
That's right. There was integration on a scale that the ancient world had never seen, blending Asian troops and Europeans in the same armed force.
And that was part of Alexander's idea, again, of creating this sort of pan-Asiatic, Southern European, I guess, force, right?
That's right. Yes, unification on a grand scale, bringing the two continents together that had been at war for centuries, even planning to transplant populations from Asia to Europe and Europe to Asia so that there would no longer be any enmity between them.
And of course, the rank-and-file soldiers had problems with this. So did some of the captains as well. He would, like the Romans later, when he would come into a conquered territory, he would basically flatter the chieftain and oftentimes give them big gifts to basically command fealty. And the captains didn't particularly like this.
Yes. Yes, I tell the story in the book of one crusty old infantry soldier named Meleager, who was the leader of the revolt that put Philip III on the throne, who saw Alexander giving a huge sum of money to an Indian Raja and sneered something like, well, how nice for you that you found a man in India worth 1,000 talents of silver. And Alexander didn't like that much, and the man never got promoted after that. One reason why he ended up a mutineer after Alexander's death.
Now, after his death, the whole Macedonian culture was based on the all-powerful king, and now all of a sudden you have two kings, Philip III, Alexander IV, one of which is incapacitated to rule, the other's a baby, a child. This had to obviously throw this whole culture into all sorts of cultural shocks.
Yes. They were clearly making up new rules as they went along, much as we see the central bankers of the world doing nowadays. Trying to survive the crisis, trying to get through a crisis of leadership, and hope that some stable order would emerge. And the creating of a joint kingship was a necessity forced on them by the revolt of the infantry. They had to form a compromise so that the army could be reunited. And neither king was able to rule, so they had to appoint a board of regents, and the regents had to be chosen carefully so that all the major players in the army, in the hierarchy, would have positions of power, and no one would feel tempted to reject the arrangement. And it was touch and go for the entire period.
Mm. And was it a sort of a statement that the army had grown so powerful through its victories that it was really controlling forces in a way perhaps it had never happened before in the ancient world?
That's correct. This was the most powerful force of armed men that had ever been seen, and they knew that. They knew that their services were indispensable. So they knew that when they rebelled in India and forced Alexander to turn around, and his willingness to do that showed how powerful they were. So after his death, they had a sense that they were the kingmakers, and on their backs, the future of the empire rested.
My guest today is James Rahm, a professor of the classics at Bard College. He's the author of Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire. It's published by Knopf. It's a fascinating account of the death of Alexander and how eventually the Macedonian Empire basically crumbled within, 30 years after Alexander's death?
Well, I cover 7 years. The process of fragmentation was sort of irreversible after 7 years, so that's the point at which I chose to end the story. You could go on for 40 years if you wanted to cover all of the struggles of Alexander's generals, but I thought that 7 years really told the story in its essence, because it showed how events had become irreversible.
So give us a sense of the seven generals that sort of vied for the possession of the empire. Ptolemy is one. We probably know that best because the Ptolemaic Empire continued around Egypt for a long time. But there were others, too. Tell us a little bit about these seven bodyguards that were vying for power.
Well, not all the seven had a claim on executive leadership. Ptolemy, as you say, is one of the leaders, and the great-great-grandfather times 13 of Cleopatra, the last of the Macedonian line in Egypt. But competing with Ptolemy was a man who was in an even stronger position at the start of the struggle, a man named Perdiccas. He was the one to whom Alexander passed a ring from his sickbed that signified executive power. So he evidently wanted Perdiccas to take over, at least temporarily, after his death. And Perdiccas did so. He was the head of the Board of Regents, managing the two kings. And Ptolemy, strikingly, was not on that board. So there was an immediate rivalry between Perdiccas and Ptolemy that quickly erupted into a civil war within 2 years' time. Then there was a man named Antipater, who had been left behind in Macedonia when Alexander went on his invasion. He was sort of the head of the home guard. He was in his 70s at the time that Alexander died, and the grand old man of Macedonian politics, who had great moral authority, especially since he'd stayed home and was well known to the native population of Macedonia. The generals who went east had not been seen there for 12 years, so they were strangers to their own people. So these are the three men who I think of as the central contestants for power at the time of Alexander's death, and two others quickly got involved in the years following.
And one of the most interesting was this Greek, who was actually like a personal secretary who eventually became a military leader, Eumenes.
Yes. Eumenes started off as a secretary, just as you say, and Alexander promoted him to a military role in the last year of Alexander's life. But even so, he had almost no fighting experience. But he had a lot of pluck and talent and smarts. The Greeks were very clever people, and Eumenes managed to outsmart many of the Macedonians who he ended up fighting.
Now, how big a divide between Macedonians and Greeks were there in Alexander's empire? Was there a big divide? I mean, obviously it was different than, say, a Persian or an Indian who would be serving in the empire, but still there were divides between who could really control Macedonians? It wasn't going to be Greeks, right?
Right. Yes, this is a very vexed question, and there's some evidence that the Macedonians were, in some essential sense, a Greek race themselves. And I don't want to get into that controversy, but it's clear that in the times that I'm discussing, there was a culture gap between the two peoples, and they thought of one another as aliens. So the Greeks who went along with Alexander's army were allies, but a separate people. And Eumenes, being Greek, was an outsider to their power structure and could not marry a member of the royal family, certainly could not come to the throne himself. So he was in a very anomalous position, fighting as an outsider to try to defend the Macedonian royal house.
Well, you mentioned the fact that civil wars started within just a few years. How did they end up dividing the Macedonian Empire?
Well, it was never a conscious decision to divide it. It was the end result of a lot of smaller decisions or circumstances that no one had any control over. The power-sharing arrangement that Perdiccas struck in Babylon in just the weeks after Alexander's death was designed to keep the empire together. But there was always a problem of the Europe-Asia divide, how to keep the two continents together. That was a problem Alexander had given a lot of thought to and had a lot of plans for, but those plans quickly fell apart, and it was clear that Europe and Asia were separating again in just the first month of Alexander's death. Then there was the problem of Egypt, which was nominally a part of the empire, but was separated by the continental division of Africa and Asia, and was very hard to invade, given its natural boundaries, natural water boundaries. So when Ptolemy got possession of Egypt as a sort of governor under Perdiccas, it was clear that he represented a threat of secession. And he made that threat good very soon after arriving in Egypt by stealing the body of Alexander and bringing it to Egypt.
And to Alexandria.
Well, eventually to Alexandria. Alexandria was just being built at that time.
Uh-huh.
And he had not taken up residence there. But eventually he moved it to Alexandria, where it was on display for centuries as a token of the power of the Ptolemies. So once that move had been made, that was sort of a declaration of independence. Egypt established itself as a separate kingdom, and Perdiccas had to go and fight in order to try and get Egypt back and get the body back, and was unsuccessful. Yes, the sort of climax of the action in the first half of my book is the invasion of Egypt by Perdiccas, which was a terrible, terrible debacle for his army and produced some horrific losses.
Out of the empire, you have Ptolemy in the Middle East, basically up to, I guess, probably what we'd say is modern-day Lebanon and Syria. Then you have the whole of Asia under Antigonus.
Now, yes.
How does Antigonus, where does he come into the story?
Well, Antigonus is a character who no one would have thought at the outset would have been a contestant for power. He was a man in his 60s. Famously one-eyed after losing an eye in battle, and some people called him Cyclops. He was a great big bear of a man who had big appetites for wine and women. He had never shown any signs of grasping for power, but in the aftermath of Alexander's death, when it was clear that you could have a try at the brass ring, at control of the whole empire, just by virtue of controlling an army, Antigonus got into the fray and became the trusted ally of Antipater, and Antipater gave him an army with which to control Asia on his behalf, And that army gradually increased after numerous victories, and Antigonus came out the Lord of Asia.
Now, Antipater was actually the home guard ruler, correct?
Yes.
The alliance with Antigonus means he actually controlled Asia, not necessarily Macedonia.
Yes. He invaded Asia in an effort to oust Perdiccas from power. After Perdiccas had become mistrusted and was thought to be trying to overthrow the other members of the ruling junta, take sole power for himself, Antipater declared war on Perdiccas and invaded Asia. So you had Antipater invading Asia at the same time that Perdiccas was invading Egypt to try to get Ptolemy, bring Ptolemy to heel.
This has all the makings of a huge gang war.
It is a huge gang war with the entire world as the turf, which is at stake, the entire world known to the Greeks and Macedonians.
Of course, I would think all this infighting basically set the stage for the Macedonian Empire to contract, too.
There was some contraction, but not as much as one would expect. The principal loss was from the Far East, the province the Greek called India, which we think of as more as Pakistan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Quickly fell away, and I described that in my book. A native ruler, Chandragupta, founded an army and won back the territory that Alexander had taken there. But the other peoples of Asia were surprisingly tractable. They waited to see what the outcome of the succession struggle would be because they had no other ruler to look to for their future. They were content to accept the Macedonians as their sovereigns. It was just a question of which Macedonian it was going to be.
Hmm. Were the Macedonians benevolent rulers over their conquered territories, or were they pretty ruthless?
No, they were fairly benevolent. They did not see themselves as plunderers in the mold of Genghis Khan. They were attempting to establish a long-term sovereignty over their conquered territories, and they used much the same administrative structure and taxation structure that the Persians had used before them. So the populations were used to being taxed and governed by the Persians, and the Macedonians simply continued that practice.
Hmm.
In some ways, they were more tolerant than the Persians because, as I say, Alexander was determined to create a world culture uniting Europe and Asia, and he participated in religious rites in places like Babylon and Egypt to show that he could adapt to local ways.
Well, it's a fascinating story of all the infighting between these generals at the death of, you know, the great leader, and just as any other sort of political vacuum, the politics are endlessly fascinating, whether it's 2,300 years ago or last week.
Yes, it's a very contemporary story. It's about the perils of politics, the chaos that follows a great project that failed for lack of leadership. In many ways, it's parallel to what the European Union is going through today, a great unification project that doesn't have adequate leadership and is therefore falling apart and fragmenting before our eyes.
Mm. Well, James Rahm, we appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
James Rahm is a professor of the classics at Bard College and the author of Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire, a new history published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.